I can totally see people that are super married to DIY FX being like, you sold out. But like, if DIY means that I should put in a ton of effort so that you can do what you want and not have to pay me anything, then fuck DIY.
Oof, sounds harsh, I know, but when gig life and real life collide, it's not pretty. I'm Mike Moschetto. This is Selling Out. I'm the casino that pays nothing when you win. Please put your money in. Hi. Hello. How are you? Thanks for tuning in or logging on or surfing the web over to another episode of Selling Out. I don't really know what the term would be. You don't really tune anything to find it. It guess just shows up on your phone and your feed, whatever. In any case, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Moschetto, and my guest today is Michael Full. You might know Michael from his emo band, Secret Stuff. Got a couple of releases out on Spartan Records, a very underrated label. He's also in a newer band called Low Mass that I'm very excited about. And if you live in the vicinity of Nashville, Tennessee, and you've gone to see bands play at a DIY space or a house show in the last few years, there's a good chance you've attended a Michael Full joint. So we talked about his old show house, Exponent Manor, that I've had the pleasure of playing a couple times, and how he actually wound up in court. My dude had to literally fight for his right to party, and he won. So that's good. Sometimes the system works. We also chatted about ambition and success and what's fair in DIY and so much more. He's just a friendly, talented, hardworking, genuine guy. So here's Michael. So you do a lot of different things.
Yes.
Central to music and DIY and underground and all that. When you introduce yourself, like, I guess it depends situationally, but how do you think of yourself?
I guess recently I've been kind of pivoting a little.
Sure.
Like, I haven't been doing as much promoting or booking as in Nashville as I used to do because I don't have the house that I lived at anymore. And so it's whenever you don't have direct control over the calendar, it's a lot harder to do as much work for as many people. So I've been like focusing a lot more on Secret Stuff. And then I joined another band called Low Mass. So I've been focusing a lot more on the music aspect of it than the business side, which has been nice because there's like a ton of stuff that's been happening in my personal life that if I was in control of like so many people's touring schedules like I used to be, then it just would have been a recipe for disaster.
Right, because you were at least at one point, you had the house, you had Exponent Manor, you were booking presumably other places around Nashville,
yes,
not exclusively the house, though that's a great thing to have. You were booking other people's tours.
Yeah.
And you had your own music projects.
Yeah, and then at that point I was still in college too.
Jeez, okay.
Yeah.
And then probably working in some...
I was working probably 30 hours a week at a barbecue restaurant.
So did you sleep or will you doze off in the middle of this?
Yeah,
or?
I mean, it was very, very fun. And I mean, I didn't have as much responsibilities in terms of like personal relationships or like now I've got a dog, you know, which is not, you know, like crazy, like, oh, dogs are trainers for babies and stuff like some people say, but it is still a lot of work.
I can see it. I can see it. But what came first in all of this? My guess would be that it was music, like playing music.
Yeah, sort of. I played in a band in high school in Christiansburg, Virginia, which is kind of like in the middle of nowhere.
That's right. Because I was going to say the first time I think I met you before I knew that you did music, it was as like a concert goer. And I mean, not in like a passive, you know, I go to shows once in a while sense. It was like we were in Blacksburg playing the I Got Brains Fest. I think that's where we met, right?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. And so I don't think you were still living there. I think you
had moved
to Nashville,
yeah,
but you
I moved to Nashville, but I came back for that. And that was on, like, I definitely credit those two festivals, I Got Brains Fest 1 and 2, as, like, my biggest entryway into DIY and into understanding,
oh, really?
Like, what DIY really was.
I caught you early.
Yeah, you did. Because, I mean, before I played in a band in high school, and I was still doing, like, a lot of sports and stuff then, so it wasn't my main focus. But when you're in high school and you're not in a town that other tours come through, you kind of have to book your own shows.
Yes.
And so that's like what we would do is my best friend at the time, his dad was the pastor of a church. And so we would just like use space in the church to throw shows.
That's
and sick. The businessman side of me was like, oh, this is cool. Like I can buy some pizzas for cheap, sell them for a little bit more, blah, 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 capitalism, yay. And
so you kind of fell into, like you said, the business out of necessity.
Exactly, yeah. And a similar thing happened once I went to college. I went to Belmont in Nashville, and it was a similar thing where I started a band, and I didn't have the relationships yet of who do I hit up to open these shows. So I just started booking our own shows. There was a place on campus called Boulevard, which was just a music store, and I convinced the owner there to let us, you know, move some of the gear out of the way and throw shows there. And it was a lot of fun. And then eventually people started coming to me and being like, hey, can you book us shows? It just kind of like organically grew from there. And I started doing more stuff at like a venue called Rocket Town. And when their room fee went up to a point which was unsustainable, I got involved with this DIY spot called the Owl Farm. And how Exponent really came about was there were like probably 14 other promoters that were booking at the Owl Farm at the time. And so there were not days available at the calendar all the time. And people would hit me up and want to play. I'd be like, oh, I can't do it. And I wanted to avoid that happening as often as possible. So I set out whenever I moved out of my dorm room to find a house that I could conceivably throw house shows at. And just, I happened to stumble upon like the perfect one, honestly. Like,
you did.
A lot of rooms upstairs. Downstairs was its own thing. Like we had our own world upstairs where everyone lived. And then downstairs there was a room for all the gear, a room to play, a living room where everyone could chill, a back porch, and then a kitchen where everyone would sell merch, where we'd put out the pizzas that we got for free because Two Boots Pizza sponsored our house.
That's right.
It was crazy. Yeah.
I don't want to say that was the best part, but
no, but it's definitely like
a huge perk.
Whenever you're on tour and you don't have to pay for food, and when it's like not just like Little Caesars,
right?
It's really great.
That is huge.
Yeah.
It's almost surprising to me in a city like Nashville, which is so renowned as being a music city, that mm-hmm. there would just be all this congestion around one venue. Is it like maybe a hostility to underground music, or is it, were there other spots that were equally backed up or?
Sort of. I mean, that was really like one of the only DIY spots at the time.
That was the one that I heard about.
Yeah, there were certainly like some other houses that were doing stuff, but they were a lot more niche.
Sure.
So I think the Owl Farm's like openness to a wide variety of genres is what made it so indispensable.
And so who ran, I mean, you guys booked it in a sort of a collective, but whose space was it
that they were opening up to? It was a person called Rose, and then another person called Jazzy, who they both do their own thing now. I believe Jazzy moved to Richmond with their partner. And once the Owl Farm was done, we were all kind of like looking for our own spaces and our own things. And they started doing some stuff at some other spaces I can't remember the exact names of, because they operated in another different world than I typically did. But it was great because they managed the Owl Farm, and like they managed all the funds for it and everything. And it was kind of a trust thing, like make sure you leave 25% of whatever is made in this cash box and stuff. So it was definitely like not super heavily monitored or anything. It was you have the privilege to use this space. Please make sure that we can keep the lights on.
Yeah, that's good. Because I mean, as opposed to having just a flat room cost, right?
Like, yeah.
If the show doesn't do well, you're not on the hook for it.
Exactly.
And it does, you know, obviously it incentivizes you to get people there and through the door and mm-hmm. everything, not only for the band's purposes, but just for the people who own the space.
And I always did a similar thing too at my house, where like, obviously if a show didn't do super well, you know, if there's 10 people paid at $5, like I'm going to give all $50 to the band.
Sure.
But say we throw a show where it's $5 and 100 people come, I'll give the band, you know, $400 and like keep $100 and use it to pay for all the shit that gets broken in my house.
Right. You know? Yeah. That's what I was just going to say. Like, I think some people get weirded out at the concept of house venues and people who operate those things.
Yeah.
Taking any cut of it, because it's like, well, it's all profit margin. But what do you say to those people? Obviously, I mean, like you said, like,
I spent the vast majority of my time for 3 years putting on shows at the house.
You put on some huge shows too.
I did, yeah. I was.
Did you have Counterparts?
Counterparts played.
That's crazy.
That was a free show. We announced that 4 hours ahead of time, and like 250 people showed up. It was totally insane.
God bless
and then
you.
Like on the other side of that, we did a show for Beartooth, and there was like a contract, and Red Bull sent out a film team from Australia to film the whole thing. And I did an interview for AP in my living room. And it was very weird. Like, so there are totally different sides. And I can totally see people that are super married to DIY FX being like, you sold out, you know, whatever. But like, I managed to make that band a ton of money. And sure, I made a cut from that, but should I not for all the work that I did?
Right. You and know, it's like a personal liability thing, yeah, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you don't own the place. Exactly. Right? You're renting it. Yeah. Like, you could get thrown out anytime.
Yeah. And I mean, like, there was a show where the floor collapsed and I spent money, like.
In your living room?
In my living room.
Jeez.
The floor collapsed and I spent money putting up new floor supports and everything like that. And when we moved out on bad terms, not due to shows at all, just simply due to the rapid gentrification of Nashville and the fact that the owner could sell the house for 5 times what they bought it for in 4 years of ownership.
Wow. And thanks in no small part to your replacement of some floors.
Exactly. Well, yeah, no, it's funny.
Probably had new floors on the listing.
I did a ton of stuff right before they attempted to evict us to fix it all up. I was on tour and I got a call from my roommate. He was like, hey, there's an inspector here, which is illegal in our lease. They are
like a surprise.
They're supposed to give us at least 24 hours notice.
Sure.
But there's an inspector here, whatever. And technically there were only two of us on the lease, 5 people living there. It was a four-bedroom, four-living-room house. Wow. So one of the living rooms was a bedroom. There are 5 people living there. But technically, those other 3 people were not supposed to be there.
Not on the lease kind of thing.
You're only allowed to have, at max, 3 people on the lease, which is very strange for
that is weird.
A house that has more bedrooms than that. But the inspector never saw those people or anything. They just saw the house was kind of in shambles, and they were like, fix all this stuff. We were like, okay. So we fixed everything, and they came back and did another inspection. Like, I got that email. They said, you have 2 weeks to fix it. I was on tour for another 10 days, came back, stayed up 4 days straight, repainted the whole house, did a ton of work, making it look very, very nice. And they came back and they're like, this is great. Like, so we can stay? They're like, yeah, sure. Awesome. Cool. Month goes by. I'm at home in Virginia and I get a call on Christmas Day. Hey, they just nailed an eviction notice to our door.
Get the fuck out.
Yeah. So I go back a week later, and like the day after I get back, we go to court. And I just watch this lawyer for this realty company, because it wasn't the like owner who managed it. It was a realty company that managed it. And they just call case after case after case where they're evicting these people and the people aren't there. So it's just like Tandem Realty wins. Boom, 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 boom. And they call our case. Our lawyer stands up. Their lawyer looks over at our lawyer and is like, oh shit. And he's like, could I have a sidebar, Your Honor? And they walk outside, come back in, and he's like, yeah, they'll drop the case and give you your security deposit back if you guys leave by the end of the month. And well, we had 2 shows after it happened, one for my buds in Ivadel, and then the last show that ever happened there.
Our buds in Ivadel.
Yeah. Amen. The last show that ever happened there was for this power violence band, ACXDC.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And it was, I mean, the house looked great. I took a ton of pictures from it. And they actually use those pictures in the Craigslist listing for rent now. When I lived there, it was $975 a month total. Now it's $2,500 a month total, plus $2,500 security deposit, first and last month's rent due at move-in.
And is it still capped at 3 people living there?
I don't know. I actually delivered a pizza there the other day.
Oh, man, that's
and
brutal.
And I was like, this is – I like knocked on the door and I was like, this is weird, but like, could I come in and take a look around for a second? I used to live here. And they were like, holy shit, you're the dude. And I'm like, what? And they're like, no, we know about you. And so I walked in and just like hung out, and it's just a bunch of Vanderbilt college kids smoking weed in there. And I kind of really want to knock on the door and be like, hey – I will pay half of your rent for a month. Let me do another show here. And like, it would be amazing. I'm not saying that it's going to happen, but it would be very, very fun to do a throwback, you know.
That would be cool.
Have a bunch of bands that were like very important to me playing there.
Yeah.
All that to say, the house was super important to me. And I think it's definitely like one of the most foundational parts of who I am. Like I learned way more running that house, throwing like almost 400 shows in 3 years there than I did in 4 years of music business school. And I guess to circle back around to your question of like, what do you say to people that are uncomfortable with the house taking a cut is like, why am I required to give of myself for 3.5 years so much effort, so much time, honestly, so much money, so that other people can have a good time? Like, why should the burden only fall on one person? And whenever another house in Nashville called The Other Basement fell apart, they got, not really fell apart, Belmont bought the house and caused them to move out. They needed places to throw shows, so I let them throw shows at my house. I was like, you guys take 70% of the money, I'll take 30% of the money, because it's my house, and just so that we can make sure that everything stays above board. And I remember the person who I let throw shows there one time, a show, two of our inputs got broken. I had to hunt them down for like $40 or something. Like, the band still made a decent amount of money. They had to pay like one touring band. And I wake up the next day and them and all of their friends had just like flamed me on the internet and were just like, fake DIY bullshit, like capitalists taking money, blah, blah, all this stuff. And like, even they brought it up in an interview with a magazine and like, didn't call me out specifically by name, but they were like, there are some houses in Nashville that are masquerading as DIY and they totally are not. And I'm like, if DIY means that I should put in a ton of effort so that you can do what you want and not have to pay me anything, then fuck DIY.
Take me with you, I got nowhere to be. This is a one-night ride, think I'm alone inside. I left a part of me behind. And I can't forget you, you watched a part of me die. So I held onto your hand, you threw me into a trance. I'm a sleepwalker in flight. I'm gonna walk on by, went through my whole life, holding on my fortitude. If it's what I make it, then I'll leave you alone, and I'll move on without a sound.
How much do you think that same kind of mindset spills over into, I think people expect a lot from artists now. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what caused the sea change. And I want to say maybe it was like, I don't know, Radiohead, pay what you want thing. Maybe that kind of opened the floodgates to this expectation that art should be free. And I think that it should be accessible and affordable.
Absolutely.
But there's a cost to all of it. How do you navigate that kind of mindset? Because you can't.
I mean, the world that we live in is currently set up in a capitalistic way. And if you truly value the art that your favorite artists are creating, then you should want them to be able to live a sustainable life off of that. You know, like, I'm not asking to be rich. I'm asking to be able to pay my rent and bills off of my art, you know, and people don't get that a lot of times. And, you know, they think that artists themselves are being exploitative. And I would argue that oftentimes it's fan bases, unreasonable expectations that creates the real exploitation.
Like, exploitative of what? Of like a gas tank worth of money? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And it's like, I think you could just as easily say to anyone who's saying like, oh, this house is fake DIY, it's like, yeah, why don't you come see me at the pizza place that I work at? Because obviously the house show thing isn't paying the bills. Like,
yeah.
I'm not, you know, I'm not like raking it in from like secret stuff money.
Yeah.
And so here's another venture that I want to bring up is More Than Me.
Yeah.
Touring.
Mm-hmm.
Booking tours for other people.
Yes.
You have to like doing it, at least. You have to find some kind of satisfaction because it's not a lot
like
of fun.
I joke around a lot with like my friends that are promoters and especially my friends that are also agents that booking is the worst part of the music industry. It's like the most thankless job and it's a ton of work.
When does that come in? Like, when do you decide to start not necessarily doing it yourself? I mean, I guess you're doing it yourself.
Helping other people
do it themselves.
Do it themselves is together.
Does that speak to like a larger aspirational kind of mindset, like where like DIY is cool, but everyone kind of wants to get to the point where somebody's doing stuff for them?
Yeah, and I was literally having this conversation with Tyler from Save Face on the drive over here, where we were talking about, you know, like, honestly, the biggest reason why I would want to get to a point where our bands were, you know, quote unquote, big and we had a team around us is that it would free up more time to be able to create more meaningful art.
Exactly.
Like, that's honestly my whole end game is like, I want to be able to create art that matters to people. And I don't want it to just be like, oh, I have to go home and I have to work 70 hours a week delivering food and all this stuff where I don't have time to make the album that I want. And that's literally like the story of my summer is we, you know, we recorded all these instrumental demos in May over 3 days. I had half the songs done lyrically and it took me like 3.5 months because I just did not have time to sit down and like try to make art. I literally finished the last 2 songs lyrics the day before we left for this tour because it was just like, I have to get it done so that we can go and shop these demos around so that I can find someone that's going to help me pay for this art. Because otherwise, I'm going to have to postpone studio time until I personally can pull in the thousands of dollars that it's going to take to create this thing in the way that I want.
You're telling me.
You know, I basically would use the money that I made booking tours to be like, okay, this is my savings. I'm putting this into a mutual fund or Bitcoin because it's essentially money that I don't need immediately to be able to live. Like, that's why I have a job.
It's like funny.
This other stuff I can like put away so that I can feel, okay, I can still chase these creative endeavors and not wreck my 40s through 70s, you know?
See, that's just in doing that, you're leagues ahead of most other folks doing this.
Yeah.
Because I haven't been like in a regular touring rotation since, you know, March of 2016 was the last long run I went on. I've done like a week here, a week there. But since then, I have a savings account now.
Yeah.
And it's not like, it's not much, but you know, that should have started when I got out of college.
It feels good too, honestly.
Yeah, it feels
like
nice.
Having that safety net is, it provides so much mental comfort and emotional support. And like, you know, they say money can't buy happiness, but it sure as hell can keep some anxiety away.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know that it necessarily feels better than being out doing what you're doing and like getting out there.
And that's the gamble that I'm taking is that I don't think it does. You know, like otherwise I'd like to think I'm a fairly logical person. And if I thought that music was not going to be as fulfilling as working a full-time job at home and spending all my time with my girlfriend and dog, then I wouldn't do music.
Right.
You know, because no reasonable person would.
Opportunity cost.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how much of it I would consider to be like a rational, but in terms of booking other people's shit, are you still doing it?
Yeah, I'm still doing it. I'm about to get started on doing some more stuff for next year. Like I said, I took a little bit of a break. I mean, it's been a rough year. I've had a lot of, you know, like bad things happen to people in my family and car wrecks and et cetera, you know. So it's like I said before, it's nice to not have that responsibility on my shoulder, but I think I'm ready to like take on more.
Okay.
And which is not something I thought I would be saying at this point.
Okay. So you kind of like ramped up for a while, got really into it, and then scaled back.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I had a roster that was a lot bigger. I mean, some of my bands have been poached, moved on to like larger agencies and stuff, which is
good.
It's good. I mean, it's something that you know will happen.
Sure.
And you just have to hope that you did a good enough job that they'll be loyal for as long as they feasibly can be. And like, I don't want anyone's careers or their pursuit of art to be held back by any loyalty to me if I'm not doing a good enough job.
Sure.
And I'll be the first to admit that I've totally fumbled some tours and stuff, but everyone does. And so
I've had my own experiences with folks doing that.
And
it's funny because that person who, well, he didn't actually fumble our tour, but everyone else around us that was working with this individual that did happen.
I know who you're talking about.
I think you probably do.
Yeah.
So we actually got a tour out of it, which is crazy.
It's funny that person's fumbles is, I think I would credit as actually being what started more than me touring.
Really?
Yeah. Because a lot of my friends were working with them and had very negative experiences and were kind of left hanging. And at the time I was pretty much just booking for secret stuff. And I was like, I have these contacts. I know how to put together tours. You know, we toured a lot more than a lot of similar bands in our like bracket,
sure,
I would say. So I was like, why don't I put these to work helping my friends? And that's how it kind of helped. And that's kind of where the name More Than Me came from too, is like, I wanted to,
that makes sense,
like give back to more than just me. And ironically enough, it has like pretty consistently always been like just me doing it though. Like I've had some people that I've worked with, but they've come and gone for various reasons.
Yeah.
And it can be definitely stressful to have all of that fall right on only one person's shoulders.
Absolutely. It's kind of funny. Did you find when you were booking other people's tours, were you more effective at it, or at least more able to devote time when you were on tour yourself? Because that was the experience that I had.
Really?
Because the guy who booked us was... It was hard to get in touch with him, or at least it was hard to hear back until his band was on this like full US run. Yeah. And he would like respond like that because he's sitting in the van doing
nothing. He just had time in the van. And I honestly had kind of an opposite experience.
Huh.
Like I do kind of get that feeling like, oh, like especially the first week of being on a tour, it's like, okay, I have time in a van. And if I'm like riding with another band or whatever, then yeah. But other times it's like, touring takes up a lot of your mental energy and stuff, and like you give a lot, you're very emotionally invested in your sets and stuff, and so after that I just like sometimes I don't want to be in constant communication with a ton of other people. I'm already being very outgoing and extroverted at a show. I don't want to have to do that in my alone time, so I just would rather, you know, read or play Civilization 5 on my computer. You know,
so how often, you know, how much in a year are you on the road? It could be just you, and it could be you with a band, like with Secret Stuff full band or with another band. Or
over the past 3 years where we've been like fairly active, it's been over 100 days a year.
Wow.
Last year we broke 150. This year I purposely scaled back because I knew that I was getting a dog. And you were
writing a record.
Exactly.
It seems like
I'm writing a record, and like I know that realistically it'll be out like in the summer.
Right.
So I'm expecting for the second half of 2018 to be out like almost the entire time, because I want to really push it as hard as I can. And you know, maybe hit the next level if possible. But like I said before, I just want to be able to create art in a sustainable way.
You've got to be like me where you plan out like a whole year. Like,
yeah,
we'll do a month at the beginning of the year. We take a few months off to recoup or something like that. How does that kind of how you structure it?
Yeah. And I mean, I kind of take it as it comes sometimes too, though, because I want to be on tour with bands that I really like.
Oh, so you get offers.
So yeah.
Ooh,
so if other people are, you know, going out on tours and stuff, and then I'll be like, yeah, let's do it. Like, for example, for this tour, I've been Save Faces agent for like 3 years.
Oh.
And they were going to be on a West Coast tour right before this, but it ended up not working out. Some stuff wasn't coming together, and they were like, we should definitely take some time for ourselves, because they hit it hard. They've done like 220 days in the past 17 months or something.
It's pretty
crazy. They are true road warriors. So this is a very nice tour, because they're about to be at the end of their album cycle and they've got a new record. And it was just like, let's just go on tour with people that we really like and not worry so much about whether or not the shows are good or bad. Just like be out there and enjoy the process. So like, I would say, yeah, I plan my year, but I leave myself more open than some other people.
And is part of that that you're kind of, as Secret Stuff, you're adaptable to play solo or with your...
Definitely. I mean, and if I had my way, I'd be playing full band every tour, except for, you know, the tours that are specifically marketed as solo tours, because I really like those. But whenever I'm doing solo on a tour that was booked for me to be full band, sometimes the venues are different, and sometimes I'm playing with, you know, a bunch of, like,
loud rock bands, you know?
And so it's like, oh, are these people that are here to rock out really going to care about this guy whining on the mic over ultra reverb-y guitar by himself? And a lot of times I'm surprised that people, you know, stay inside. They don't just go smoke the whole time.
That's good.
But
no, they want to hear.
But sometimes they do, and it's super disheartening when that happens.
No, what they want to hear is to hear an ultra whiny guy on the mic with a bassist and a drummer.
Yes, exactly. See, they're like, where's
rhythm section?
Where's the rhythm?
Changes everything.
My dad always, he would like listen to my music, and he'd be like, it's gotta have a beat, son. It's gotta have a beat. I just got all eyes on the future, and you're nothing more than a kid. I guess foresight is my curse. I love my parents so, so much, but they are so tone deaf. My sister can sing very well, and I do not know where either of us got it at all, because we're not a musical family, like, at all.
What got you into it, then?
It's going to sound just, like, super cheesy, but just, like, listening to The Devil and God in sixth grade.
I was just so...
Whoops, hey everybody, Mike here. Obviously now you can tell that this episode of Selling Out was recorded conveniently right before we found out that Jesse Lacey is a great big piece of shit, or maybe you already knew that. I left this one reference in, I thought it was contextually important, but if you hear any kind of choppy edits between here and the rest of the interview, that would be me removing any extraneous, superfluous references to unsavory characters like that. If you have any questions, concerns, any pause about editorial decisions that I've made in cutting these shows, feel free to reach out to me at sellingoutpodcast@gmail.com. I think we're clear of that from here on out, though. Should be out of the woods. So enjoy the rest of the interview. Thanks. Bye.
And there came a time in my life in like junior year of high school where I was like, I was a pretty good lacrosse player in high school, and I was getting like some college offers, and I was thinking like, oh, do I want to pursue this and then go into medicine, or do I want to go to Belmont and pursue music and music business? And I was just thinking like, what is going to be more different every day? What can I do longer and still feel fresh? And I thought music, and certainly that's a lot harder, less sustainable choice, but right. I don't regret it at all, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's really how that all came about.
Does that still factor in today? Like, what's your ideal situation? Like, what are you working toward? Or is it just a constant work?
It's a constant work. I just want to be able to create music. And I said this on, my buddy Alex hosts a podcast called The Local Wave.
Oh yeah. I listened to it in preparation for this. So I wouldn't go over the same shit on That was the one little thing I did.
Nice.
I tried.
And so, I mean, like I said there before, I want to be the biggest fucking band in the world. And like, yeah, that might be like, oh, wow, who is this asshole? But I don't know. I mean, like, I want to create meaningful art, and I want my art to be meaningful to as many people as possible. That doesn't mean that I won't be happy if that's not what happens.
Right.
Like, I still, like,
I mean, when you get right down to it, that's got to be everybody.
Yeah, right? Exactly. I mean, like,
and I don't think they would admit it necessarily. Yes. Like, I think there's this kind of aversion to, and I kind of get it too, because I've thought, like, do you ever hear something that just, like, wicked fucking sucks? Like,
yeah.
And you're like, well, I don't want any crossover with this whole segment of people who like this thing.
Yes.
But that's such a learned way to think, because in theory it's like music is, you know, it's art. You got to share it. It is sustained and given new meaning through osmosis from person to person, or from especially in a larger scale. So I heard that was something that like my ears picked up, and I was like, huh,
yeah,
it's like an unusually unapologetic attitude.
I think specifically in DIY, there is this aversion to desiring success, or aversion to publicly proclaiming your desire for success.
Yeah, there's kind of like an aloofness, like a devil may care.
Yeah, which like, cool, you might not care, but like, this is the most important thing in the entire world to me.
I wonder if part of that comes from what you and I do musically. It's still a niche, right?
Exactly.
Like, we think there's a lot of kids who are into it, and that's cool, but it's not enough to coast by. You know, you're not like selling millions of albums or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that kind of limited audience thing has been internalized as to say like, well, there's a ceiling on this.
I think so. And I think you see the same thing happen with like, I think people feel threatened that the mainstream is starting to accept this band into their own, you know, cultural zeitgeist. And I think that that threatens the specialness of the music to some people. And like, I'll totally admit that I'm guilty of that too. We're like, band has a lot of hype.
And I think that threat is maybe warranted to some degree because it's part of that is an aversion to something like Red Bull showing up at your house and like putting you on camera and like maybe like Vice News doing a write up about like the Springfield, Illinois scene or something like that. Yeah. I get the aversion to that, but at the end of the day, it's a small community in the larger music community. There's also a shitload of bands.
Yeah.
And as much as I don't like to frame it in terms of competition, but they are competing for a limited amount of resources.
Yeah.
So like looking into a kind of a crystal ball, where does that go? Is it just more and more bands until it's kind of like a fluid barrier between artist and that relationship is certainly not like what it was.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, that the internet is all to blame or to credit for that, you know,
equal parts.
Yeah. I think that it's become so much easier to find people that share this niche interest. It's become much easier to create the music that you want to create. Just, you know, you have a laptop and do you even have an iPhone? You know, there are people that just are able to create the music that they want on
the fucking guy who did a beat for Kendrick on his iPhone.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, it will just continue to grow. And I don't necessarily see that as a problem. Like, I don't think that the barrier between consumer and creator necessarily means that there will be less consumers. I think that people that make art should also be able to appreciate other people's art. You know, I can totally see it. Like when bands are in bands, you can sometimes not want to be as vocally about what some of your friends are doing. But some of the coolest bands I've seen and some of the coolest communities I've seen have that in it, though. They have bands that are so vocally about what their friends are doing and are so for it that it like is infectious. Like, for example, I mean, even like locally here, Counterintuitive Records, like the bands that are on that are so into the other bands that are on Counterintuitive, and it's absolutely infectious and just viral. It makes you feel good.
I will say that example specifically gives me kind of an optimism about it.
Absolutely.
And it's not necessarily like a new thing. Like, I think, you know, growing up, obviously we are a couple of years separated, but that's what I remember about it is the sense of community.
Yeah.
Before the internet was always around when I was growing up, but I think it really, with social networking, it broke open geographic barriers where like not only are there more bands, but there are more bands that tour now. So
and that does create a problem with scarcity of resources.
Yeah. And the reason that I would frame it as a problem is because if there's like three shows going on in Boston tonight, it's like, you know, you're not going to put like six touring bands on a show, right?
Yeah.
Like,
that's what I think is another aspect that is good about the like greater number of bands coming up is like Secret Stuff can't play local shows the amount of times a year that we used to. You know, we want to play shows in Nashville like once every like 2 months. Like, I love playing at home, but if you play too much, you're going to kill your draw.
Yep.
And we totally did that. We like totally killed our draw where people were just like, I don't care. I'll go see them next week in their living room.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
But the thing is that there are always so many touring bands coming through that there needs to be bands that do that.
Yeah. It's just kind of, it's like a cyclical creation of demand.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
I mean, and it's not necessarily demand from, maybe kids don't want to go to shows like six nights a week.
Yeah.
Because you probably could have them. I'm like, Boston is a market that happens.
Yeah.
No, Nashville is.
Yeah.
Like, there's always six shows a night.
Just at my house.
Right.
And so, like, yeah, Exponent was very blessed to have a sort of like built in crowd too of people that would just come. There's a show at Exponent. I'm going to go hang out because I wanted to make it a space where everyone could like feel like they were at home. And the number one feedback that I always got at Exponent was like, it doesn't feel like a party. And a lot of house shows, you know, you go and it's like, it's all about the party. And it was supposed to be all about the music there. Cause like, I don't drink, that culture, you know, beguiles me. And so I didn't necessarily set out to make it not a place to go and, you know, have these debaucherous parties. But
I mean, I think people are gonna do that.
Yeah, and like that's fine. And there totally were people. I mean, like Free Throw loves to drink, and they play shows at my house all the time. But that's not the main focus.
And I also think that having a few like drunk folks is like, well, you know, maybe they'll open the wallet up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know,
I've totally sold merch to some people that thought I was in a different band because they were drunk.
That's awesome.
Another just an aside, we played a show with the Menzingers right before this tour, and this industry person came up to me and like talked to me for like 45 minutes, and it's a person that I definitely know who they are. I tried to get a job working as their assistant and stuff. They definitely do not know who I am. They thought I was in the Menzingers.
Ooh.
They were drunk and thought that I was like the front man of the Menzingers and like introduced me to his fiance and like took me backstage to hang out with Bayside and stuff. And I went and asked my friend who was the promoter for the show. I was like, yo, he thinks I'm someone else. Should I correct him? He was like, no,
definitely not.
You will just confuse him. He's not going to remember who you are in the morning anyway. Just let him
just roll with it.
Yeah. I was like, okay, cool.
That's fine.
As always, if you like what you heard today, I urge you to support Michael however you see fit. I'll have the pertinent links and info in the description of this episode. If you want to support the show, you can find out how to do that at patreon.com/sellingout, and I'm still taking submissions for what you want for bonus content at sellingoutpodcast@gmail.com or on Twitter @sellingoutad. Leave a nice rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It helps others find the show. Or you can just pick whichever friend has the worst forearm tattoos and most asymmetrical haircut and just hit them to it personally. Our theme song is No Cab Fare by Such Gold, photography by Nick DiNatale. I'm Mike Moschetto. This is Selling Out.